Good afternoon. Please be seated. This is a matter of Sergio G. versus the Judicial District, case number 68763. If parties are ready to proceed, the appellants may do so if they wish to reserve time for the petitioner. Ms. Wallner.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Deanna Moran. I represent appellant Sergio Gonzalez. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of rebuttal time. I would like to begin my oral arguments by addressing the cases cited by the CAP in the supplemental authorities filed on April 25th, 2016. Primarily, there are two cases cited in proffering that courts do not apply claim preclusion of all new allegation abuse. The two cases cited, both are unpublished and from other jurisdictions, and in both cases, new facts actually arose since the filing of the first petition. While it is true that in both these cases, the state was allowed to proceed with the second petition after gaining more concrete facts that were suspected in the first petition, that's not analogous to the case here. In the case here, what happened between petition one and petition two, the only difference was Mr. Gonzalez entering a plea to his criminal case in May of 2013. It wasn't until March 10th of 2015 that the state actually made its first attempt to make an addition to Mr. Gonzalez's case plan. So that's almost 22 months that the case sat on, or that the state sat on their hands and did nothing. There's not a single new witness, a new piece of physical evidence, or any other sort of evidence the state has claimed since the filing of the first petition outside of Mr. Gonzalez's plea. If the state, in fact, were simply waiting for a plea in the criminal matter, they would have filed soon after then, instead of waiting almost 22 months. The same office, the district attorney's office, represents both the state in the criminal proceeding and in the NS-432B proceeding. So it's interesting that the state here is arguing to the court that they had enough evidence to proceed on a beyond a reasonable doubt standard in criminal case, but is somehow claiming that they didn't have enough evidence to proceed in the 432B case, where it's a much lower standard of proof, which is a preponderance of the evidence, which the state often does. Secondly, I would like to address the other two cases where the CAP proffers that courts do not let claim preclusion override the best interest of the child. That argument is a bit overly simplistic in describing the cited cases, and both those cases cited are domestic cases. In CAP, it's from Ohio in 2001, and Child is from Mississippi in 1998. In both of those cases, race judicata was applied in domestic proceedings, but in both those cases, the petitioners actually raised an issue of change in circumstances or a material change. I do understand that the court does have to consider best interest of the child, but there's absolutely no proof that by dismissal of petition 4 that act contrary to the best interest of the subject matter in this case. The state would still maintain jurisdiction over the subject minor in the ongoing petition, petition 3. And further, Natural Father has, since the filing of petition 3, Natural Father has completed his prison sentence, he's completed parenting classes, and of his own volition completed anger management classes. DFS simply assumes that the only way for Mr. Gonzalez to correct his past actions would be to complete their specific domestic violence classes. There's also a danger in comparing 432B cases to domestic cases. This isn't a case where two parents are arguing who would be the better parent, better to raise a child or spend more time over Christmas.
Ms. Miller, I slow you down for 1 second. Yes. I just have one question you need to clarify for us. The mother, we'll refer to as Sonia M., was she and Sergio G. ever married?
To my knowledge, no. They were a couple. But they were not married.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Additionally, there's a reference that while he was incarcerated, he did all he could to complete his case plan. What was the alleged deficiency or what he was not able to complete while he was in custody, if you know?
The only deficiency would have been maintaining housing and employment, because that was impossible while he was incarcerated. At the CPR trial, he testified that his job would let him take his job, would give him his job back when he returned, and that his parents had left him a home in Pahrump. So although he was not physically living in housing, he did testify that he could he would be able to provide housing. So once Mr. Gonzalez was to be released, then his case plan would be completed, save for employment, and as soon as he got employment, his case plan would be completed. But the case plan itself, the only case plan that exists at this point, is completed. And going back to comparing these cases to domestic cases, in this case, the state took a child from a parent. There's a fundamental right involved here where there needs to be some oversight here. Natural Father was given a case plan. He was told to operate off of this case plan, and that this case plan would resolve the issues, and then reunification would be looked at. However, he operated off of this case plan for 2 years. For 2 years, he operated off of this case plan. And when he was 1 month away from completing this case plan, which would have been the release, which would have allowed him to complete those two missing factors, which would have been employment and housing, that's when the state moved to make the additions to the case plan. Neither the state nor the CAP provide any legal support when it allowed them to file a petition where absolutely no new facts have occurred since the filing of the last petition. The only new fact that has occurred would be Mr. Gonzalez's completion of his only existing case plan. There are approximately two cases referred to in the answer in which a conviction was used as a new piece of evidence. However, in both those cases, the conviction led to a very lengthy sentence. In one case, the parent was convicted to 10 years, and in one case, the parent was sentenced to death. So it wasn't the conviction itself that was a new fact in those cases. It was the length of time that the parent would be out of the child's life. So in both of those cases, a subsequent termination of parental rights was filed. The parent tried to argue res judicata, however, the court held because of this time that the parent would be serving, it would hinder any future reunification, which would be an appropriate factor to consider at a TPR hearing. In this case, the exact opposite happened. Mr. Gonzalez would have been free to be able to care for his child, but then there was a filing and an attempt to add an addition to his case plan. In the CAP's answer, there was numerous cases cited from other jurisdictions where they incorrectly proffered that the cases from other jurisdictions support that res judicata should not apply in abuse and neglect petitions. It's a bit misleading because almost all of the cases cited are in regards to termination of parental rights cases in other jurisdictions. Their parents had a second petition of termination of parental rights filed against them after a first. And then the parents raised res judicata saying that either the evidence used in the first termination should not be used against them, or that the second termination was filed by the first. And those courts, and I think appropriately, held that res judicata did not apply in those cases. That is not what Mr. Gonzalez is arguing here. What he's arguing is that petition 4, which is the first petition against Mr. Gonzalez himself, is precluded by petition 3, because there have been absolutely no new facts that would give the state the ability to file a petition under 432D since the filing.
Let me just get this straight, because we have multiple petition 3, the argument was that your client allowed the mother to use drugs while she was pregnant.
That was the state made two allegations, that he allowed the mother to use drugs, and that his incarceration left him unable to care for the child, and he was incarcerated on that.
So on petition 3, your client prevailed on that.
No, actually, he pled to the incarceration allegation.
I'm talking about the abuse and neglect petition.
Yeah, the abuse and neglect petition, he did plead to the incarceration allegation only.
Okay. But as to the other allegation, there was no adjudication.
No, it was dismissed. It was
okay. Okay, so that's a non-issue as far as we're concerned in this case. So we're just talking about petition 4 and the basis for petition 4 is alleged by the state. Okay, thank you.
Shouldn't we balance the best interest of the child in claim preclusion Or should we say Lynn does not apply in this particular case?
I think in these types of cases, the courts will always include in the best interest of the child. The court does have to take that into consideration. However, in this case, I think we can balance it because by dismissing petition 4, it would not be immediately returning the child to Mr. Gonzalez, and that would be a completely different argument. The state would still maintain jurisdiction over petition 3. It could monitor the reunification of the subject matter with Mr. Gonzalez. And then in addition to that, Mr. Gonzalez didn't simply just sit on his hands and do nothing in that time when he, by his own volition, he went and took anger management classes. He did complete parenting classes. He completed his prison sentence and completed his case plan. As I stated in my arguments, the findings and the termination were very helpful to Mr. Gonzalez, including that he contacted the Department of Family Services on a weekly basis to check up on the child. He did everything that he could do. It was the state that did not assist Mr. Gonzalez in completing the portions of his case plan that they now want him to. They let him go 2 years when they could have called the prison and discussed the curriculum and the classes that were available. They could have spoken to his caseworker. Had this been included in Petition 3, then Mr. Gonzalez could be in a very different situation now. We could be at reunification. So to argue that there's no detriment to Mr. Gonzalez, I think is completely ridiculous because Mr. Gonzalez could have completed the appropriate portions of his case plan that if it had additions to it. They have caseworkers there, they have their management classes there, they could have spoken with the teacher themselves to see if there could be an addition to the curriculum. The department has an obligation to provide reasonable efforts to help a parent complete a case plan. And had domestic violence been included in Petition 3, then they would have had that obligation. But simply what happened here is what happens in so many cases. The Department of Family Services removes the child from the parent who has gone to prison or jail, and the state does nothing. The state simply lets the time run out because they know that time only works for their detriment. Mr. Gonzalez was left on his own, and on his own, he did everything he could do. On his own, he called the Department of Family Services weekly. But the department did nothing to tell him in the state of one of those weekly conversations, hey, why don't you find out if you can do domestic violence classes while you're in prison? They didn't make a single phone call to one of the caseworkers. They haven't even explored what Mr. Gonzalez has completed while he was there, because he did complete a class, but they made no efforts to see if that would comply with what they want to see from him, the classes they want to see from him.
And we have a little over 3 minutes at this point left for you, better time before we go. Justice, do you have any questions you want to ask at this point? One last question, and we won't take your time off to see how you respond, but this is your motion. Extraordinary remedy, because you're asking us to issue a writ as to the failure to dismiss. Why should we entertain that at this point? Why should we just send it back and let the appeal stand if the parties wish to appeal afterwards? Why should we intervene at this point?
Because, Your Honor, at this point, Mr. Gonzalez and many other parents in his situation are taken advantage of. If at this point he's completing his only existing case plan, right when he completes it, then the state wants to say, well, now we want to make additions to his case plan. This is a fundamental right. Each parent does have a fundamental right to raise their own child. And when the state keeps on throwing up barriers every time they tell them, we want you to complete these things, the parent completes those things, and then once they would be obligated to reunify a child with that parent, then they throw up additions to the case plan. I think that it's very important that this be addressed by the court, because each day is a day that Mr. Gonzalez does not have his child. Mr. Gonzalez can only complete as much as he can, but the state will continue to stand in his way until they get as they want Petition 4 adjudicated.
Okay, thank you. We will shoot up your time. We'll give you a full 3 minutes on rebuttal. We'll have 2 minutes to our responding side. Ms. Smith?
Good
afternoon, Justices. May it please the Court, my name is Gwyneth Smith. I'm a Deputy District Attorney here in Clark County, and I represent the respondent, the Department of Family Services, in the case at bar today. Mr. Kolzenberg and I have discussed our time split. I'm going to be requesting 10 minutes, and he's going to be using 5 minutes of our time. In this case, Natural Father is asking for extraordinary relief in the form of a writ and asking that you find that the district court acted arbitrarily and capriciously when it determined that P4 could proceed to have an evidentiary hearing on the issue of domestic violence and how it should impact the case plan in this case.
Why did you file the fourth petition rather than do something with the third petition?
And I think that's a very good question. We did attempt to do that. So the record will show that initially, after the 157 presumption was established at the TPR hearing, Natural Father had a criminal conviction that was introduced at the TPR hearing in July of 2014, and the court at that point said that an evidentiary hearing needs to occur before reunification can take place. Following that, the case attempted to amend the case plan by a system we call NARD, which is no longer in use. But we attempted to bring it before the court to ask that domestic violence be added to the case plan. And the hearing master who heard that request denied it, saying that the allegation had not been pled and substantiated in P3, and therefore he would not sustain it. And he specifically requested that we file a P4 so that the court could take the matter to an evidentiary hearing, hear the evidence on domestic violence in the 157 presumption, and then use that to inform the case plan thereafter.
Are you trying to unify this case, or is this one that you're looking for termination by all rights?
Well, I think there's kind of two separate aspects to that question. The question of whether at this point in time, since the child has been out of the home for such a length of time, whether it's in her best interest to be reunified, I think is a question that the department has concerns about. But the question of whether that length of time is due to the failure of domestic violence being included in the case plan, I think is not as straightforward as Natural Father has presented to you today. Because in fact, as I stated, he was criminally charged and he ultimately pled to the domestic violence offense. He pled to substantial bodily harm.
This is a really odd case because the underpinnings of what's involved in this, we have a factual scenario where he was put on the carpet for not allowing his partner, who was that term, was taking drugs and he didn't do anything about it. And so the separation and the undercurrent of it was going on. And unfortunately, with a lot of people, they don't use the best methods of correction. It seems as though he is now being penalized, especially with the domestic violence not having been alleged in the beginning, to it after the fact, and then been saying, oh, by the way, since we've had this separation period, because he was incarcerated, which I don't think he wanted to be incarcerated. So it's kind of concerning that we would reach back and come forward and not say, he's out of prison, what is he today or what is he not today? That's kind of a concern that we're getting into right now.
And the facts, as they existed at the time P3 was filed, at the time P3 was filed, Natural Father was in custody and appeared in custody at his first hearing. He was not in custody on domestic violence charges. He was in custody on different charges and, in fact, was not arrested on the domestic violence charges until thereafter. We had previously filed a criminal complaint. But it was at the very early stages of that case, and the child was removed initially from Natural Mother because of the drug concerns. So while it would have been possible to make a broad allegation of domestic violence, I don't know that we had a good faith basis to make an allegation that 157, which requires a clear and convincing finding at that stage, necessarily would have been appropriate. It certainly was appropriate and was triggered by statute as soon as he entered his plea, his criminal conviction was entered, and then it was noted in the TPR proceedings. And the court there did say that they believed that he would be required to rebut this presumption. And one thing I think it's important that the court consider is that because that was the posture of the court after the TPR, the department's failure to amend his case plan and provide him with those services, I think, could be construed as a lack of reasonable efforts, and therefore we went through this process to attempt to address that with the court.
And the same question I asked counsel on your side in terms of the issue of claim preclusion versus child's best interest, how do you look at it in terms of balancing out articulating what the department is attempting to do?
And I think in child welfare cases, and when 432B is applied, 432B uniquely requires that this court consider the best interest of the children be held paramount. And in this case, claim preclusion, I don't believe that the elements are actually met, but even if they were, I think the court would nonetheless have to consider the effect on the child, even if they were. And to address the elements of claim preclusion, the first requirement requires that the parties be the same between the first and second litigation. One fact for the court to consider is that in P3, the child was not yet assigned independent counsel. So while she has independent counsel here today, and she had independent counsel through the adjudication of P4, she did not join the adjudication of P3.
And so do you know how many people were in prison in the state?
I don't know the exact number.
15,000. So your job is to, at least I thought so, I was a public defender, I'm a special public defender, and a private attorney doing criminal cases when I had a criminal case and also a neglect or abuse was to reunify. I know DAs used to go head-to-head with each other. Somebody in your position would fight to reunify the family. Somebody in the position of a criminal DA would fight for the person to go to prison. There were a lot of men that had gone to prison. And with all these people in prison, I mean, this is like unintended consequences of somebody who's serving and serving a long term, but they're out, of course they're not with the child for a long period of time. So I'm really worried about going in your favor in this case and opening the door to saying to DAs in the juvenile section that you can terminate parental rights. And that's what I'm seeing. I'm seeing that you really want to terminate this guy's parental rights is what you're saying. And I think that you're not being upfront with me by saying that you want to see how petition 4 plays out. I think that that's your idea that he's been out, she's been out, the child's been out of the home too long, and you want to terminate this fellow's parental rights. You know, he did his case plan.
He did his case plan with the absence of domestic violence counseling, which once he had been convicted, the court would not be able to reunify him with the child unless he was able to rebut that presumption. But additionally, Your Honor, in terms of your concern around the termination of parental rights, there's the length of time the child has been out of the home, but I think the court also needs to focus on the underlying facts of the incident that occurred. And in this domestic violence incident, natural father beat natural mother with an extension cord when she was 7 months pregnant with this child. And so there are facts related to that felony conviction that may also bear on a termination of parental rights proceeding, and I think certainly bear on this court's consideration of best interests of the
child. I've never seen a domestic violence case that wasn't brutal. I've never seen a murder case that wasn't brutal. I mean, this is going to happen. So, I mean, we have to face, when you're involved in the criminal justice system, whether it be in the juvenile justice system or the adult justice system, there's brutality. And the question is, do you take somebody's child away because of that situation when somebody goes and they pay the price? He paid the price. I mean, he tried very hard. I mean, it's a rarity when you see somebody who's done as much as he's been able to accomplish. I think he's done a good job. And I just worry that this is, that your real thought is to terminate this man's parental rights.
And at the time that we sought to amend the case plan, the permanency goal was reunification, and the goal of the department was not to move immediately to termination of parental rights. It was to compel him to complete domestic violence counseling to address the concerns that had arisen from his domestic violence.
But the concern is, as I look back at the record and the notes I scribbled down, it says that the father had completed his case plan to the best of his ability from inside the prison. The father had completed parenting classes and anger management classes in prison, that he did not pose a risk of serious physical, mental, and emotional harm to the minor child, and that the state had the responsibility to include domestic violence classes in the case plan and failed to do so.
And the court,
now we're coming after him for failing to do the domestic violence counseling.
And the court had further instructed in that TPR order, Your Honor, that the state should add domestic violence counseling to his case plan if we believed it was necessary. And at the review hearing following that, the case plan that was appended to that report did include domestic violence counseling. At this point, Natural Father remained in custody, and the domestic violence programming was not available to him. And I think we can certainly argue about the policy implications of what services should be available in our prison systems, and I appreciate that argument, but I don't think that we can hold the child to be put in a potentially unsafe situation.
That's the problem. It's like right now, what we have on the board is not an unsafe situation. It's kind of a neutral situation. If that's the finding that was made by the hearing officer, not the, you know, the it's always a crapshoot, it's always a problem, it's always a concern, and so we don't ask the question lightly, and I appreciate your candor to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I believe my time is up.
Mr. Pleisenberg.
Good afternoon, Your Honor, and please the court, Dan Pleisenberg for the minor child. I don't think it's a neutral situation, Justice Douglas. I think it's an unknown situation. Look, CAP lawyers are not coming into this case with the priority that we take the child away from the father.
It sounds like it, though.
Oh, no, it isn't.
But it sounds like it.
Well, it isn't. What we're looking for is reunification as our first priority. But we have to play it safe.
The district attorney agrees with you on that.
Yes.
Well, I guess that's why we have separate counsel, though.
And that is,
I'd like to hear you say that, Mr.
We do.
That seems to be a little more comfortable. At least you, or representing the child, feels maybe the child should be back with the father.
Reunification is always our first priority. And it is in this situation. But I have to make sure that it is a safe situation. I can't assume it's neutral. It is an unknown at this point. And the petitioner comes in here asking for an absolute rule that says if you could have raised these issues in the original petition, then you cannot raise them again. And I can't live with that.
Mr. Pleisenberg, the question from court and the standard law is how far should you be allowed to reach back and bring forward when the state had the opportunity in the first place and chose not to do it?
Well, I do understand that that's the situation.
That's kind of the situation. It's not a Melbourne situation you get a do-over.
Well, Judge, I think the principles apply differently here when we're trying to balance the best interests of the child.
We have the best interests of the child. We also have the best interests of a natural parent.
Absolutely.
Often we have a separation of natural parent and child merely because we're going on the four corners of the black letter law and not looking at the people. As you said, there's no guarantees.
Right. And so I'm just trying to be prudent. And I want a case plan that includes domestic violence. Now, originally, DFS tried to amend the case plan, just amend the case plan. It reminds me of a trial I had with Melissa where I started asking questions about domestic violence, and she brought up the point that it wasn't in the case plan. I backed right off that. But here they tried to, they don't care about the incarceration at this point. I don't think the length of time that he was in prison matters right now.
But I do care about the prison concerns because quite often what we see on our end is when counsel comes in on behalf of the department, the first thing they want to tell us is there's a presumption because the child is out of the household for so many months and we should apply that and just go away.
And I've seen that.
And it's concerning because I see that coming.
And so I don't see it coming, and I'll make sure it doesn't come. And Your Honor, I understand your concerns. And I read your own Justice Cherry's dissent in APM. And I understand, and we've had discussions before about whether effective assistance of counsel applies in TPR. I understand the protections that we have to have in TPR. Now, admittedly, this is abuse and neglect, but I'm not sure that we're really talking about that much of a difference. But I don't like, I mean, the way to comp- compete against these hard and fast rules that you see us proposing, which I'm not proposing, are hard and fast rules that they're coming in with and saying under claims preclusion, if it could have been raised earlier, it can't be raised again. That's just too hard and fast.
Let me ask you that, Mr. Posner. I mean, you're probably an expert on claim preclusion for many complicated civil cases here. Ms. Smith addressed it, and I thought made some good points. So what's your take on that from your experience?
First of all, I don't think that claims preclusion applies in this case, because I don't. If you read this court's opinions, if you read Weddle and you read Five Star, there's this tension about really what kind of thing should have been raised. And I hear the same tension in Justice Douglas's voice when he's talking about this. But you have to also balance that with the idea that we're talking about the best interests of the child, and I'm representing the child here. I think that really, if you look at this and say that the district judge, now admittedly you would review this de novo, but I think you need to take into account the fact that there's a child involved here. Now, everybody at this table argued in the district court, when you're dealing with children, you have to have more flexibility. You can't have a situation where if you don't raise it, you waive it. You know, Justice Cardozo's criticism of the exclusionary rule was that you let a criminal go free because the constable blundered. Now, I don't have a problem with the exclusionary rule, but I do have a problem with putting my 3-year-old client in a possible dangerous situation without us actually taking a look at it. It's a motion to dismiss. It's very easy to just go forward with the case and see whether there's anything here. And that's all that I'm suggesting that we do. I'm saying reject their hard and fast rule. And if you look at their latches argument is that he had 2 years or 22 months where he could have been doing something, that he wasn't able to do anything. That's not enough to be prejudiced under latches. Under latches, it's not delay or inconvenience. It's something that keeps you from ever being able to prevail in the case.
When you're dealing with a child, see, when you're arguing with a child, the latches should apply in a case like this. No, you're dealing with a child. And, you know, this child, maybe we'd like this man to walk right down the aisle. Maybe when the child goes to the doctor, they'll say, well, how's your father's health? I don't know. They terminated his parental rights.
No, I'm not trying to terminate his parental rights.
Let's see this. Don't you understand? We see enough of these cases. We know where they're going. We know what the DA is doing in this case.
And you've seen more than I have. And I understand that both of you
had Peru and you had Pecos and Bonanza.
Judge, I admire everybody on this court for the protections that they have of parents. I will never shirk in that. And I have many times argued the same thing. But you've got to give the child an even chance here to have the situation looked at. And that's all we're talking about. I don't dispute the court should hear this petition, but I think it should reject hard and fast rules on both sides.
Mr. Olson, there's one comment about not taking advantage of the problem. As we sit, one of the things we don't like sitting on, but as we sit on the pardons board and we listen to programming, but more importantly, lack of programming classes available when folks are incarcerated. It's not like they can pick out of a catalog and take whatever they want. It is very limited. But having said that, having chewed up your time, I'd like to give you 2 minutes to say what you need to say to us.
Thank you, Your Honor. But I think I'm working it in as we go along. And Your Honor, you're right. The anger management classes that they have in prison are not the same as the domestic violence classes that we have out in the world. So what I'm asking for is the opportunity. If you want, I will stay on this case in the district court and make sure that there's an even break for both sides. And I appreciate giving a father a good chance. I'm a father. I understand that. But I need the court also to realize that what petitioner is asking for is a hard and fast rule that doesn't work for the best interests of the child. And that's what I think this court should look at. And I think the petition should be dismissed, perhaps with instructions from the district judge to pay special attention to issues. But I don't think you can just dismiss the petition itself. The DFS tried to raise these issues in an earlier opportunity. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. First, I would like to address the contention that Department of Family Services tried to raise these issues at an earlier opportunity in Petition 3. That earlier opportunity was 1 month prior to filing Petition 4. So that was 22 months after Mr. Gonzalez had entered his plea. 2 years after they had already filed Petition 3, did they make any effort to come to the court to add this addition in? It's not like they tried a month after Mr. Gonzalez entered his plea. It wasn't like they tried 6 months after. Mr. Gonzalez continuously showed up at every hearing incarcerated. Mr. Gonzalez called his casebook on a weekly basis. His caseworker knew why he was incarcerated. And the contention that anger management classes in prison don't cover what is covered in domestic violence classes, there is absolutely no proof for that. The Department of Family Services has not made a single phone call to the directors at prison, to the caseworker, to discuss what Mr. Gonzalez went over in his anger management classes, to find out if any of it overlapped. They made absolutely no effort.
Just so that you know, we do have these partners cases that Justice Douglas was talking about, and a lot of times it's about somebody who's been somewhat brutal to somebody else, whether it be a child or an adult. We give them back their guns when we pardon them. We give them back a gun. And we don't know what the test is going to be. We don't know if we're making a mistake, right? But they all want to hunt with their grandchildren like they did with their fathers and stuff. But we give back guns freely when it comes to pardons. So, I mean, I just think that this is an abuse.
I do as well, Your Honor, and I don't think they contend that this is a hard and fast rule. This is not a hard and fast rule. I did not bring this forward lightly. The state did not try to bring this forward 6 months later. They did not try to bring it forth 1 month later after he entered his plea or after Petition 3 was filed. The state sat on their hands for 2 years. For 2 years, they waited until the moment Mr. Gonzalez had a glimmer of hope to reunify with his child. They waited until 1 month before his case plan would be completed and they would expect to work reunification efforts. And I think Your Honor is right that the state is looking at termination of parental rights, and that's exactly what they're trying to do here. And that's evidenced by their efforts to move forward with the termination of parental rights the first time, when Mr. Gonzalez had made every effort to work his case plan, while Department of Family Services sat and simply waited for a phone call from Mr. Gonzalez every week. But that's all we did.
Ms. Long, can I ask you back to the latches issue? Can you articulate legal prejudice? I understand there's prejudice in some cases, but tell us the legal prejudice that your clients sustain that would invoke the doctrine of latches.
The legal prejudice?
Yeah, that's one of the requirements for latches, the legal prejudice, and so tell us what it is.
Well, Your Honor, I think the prejudice against him is now he is going to be required to complete classes that can take months or even years. So that is a very significant amount of time that they are taking from Mr. Gonzalez, time that he could be reunified with his child. Every single day he is not with his child is a big deal. So to act like months or even a year does not matter, I think is a complete violation of the Latches Law.
Thank you.
Ms. Manana, Ms. Smith, Mr. Pilsenberg, thank you for the arguments for today. It is an emotional subject matter. Children are very important. We appreciate the arguments today. Thank you. We're in recess.